What is going on, everybody? It's your boy, Big Dave, back with another episode of The Bog Live right here for now until our Hearthfire Radio goes live, which is coming very, very soon. It's in the works. It got a little bit delayed. It's a big project, so it got a little bit delayed, but it will be available very, very soon. It will be the epicenter of heathen content, folk content for all the folk. So when that goes up, you guys will be able to sign up over there and get so many great shows, so much great content from all of your favorite people. So that's going to be coming very, very soon. Guys, I got, you know, I had a sale going on over, you know, over towards the end of whatever, towards the end of fall. I decided to extend it. Go over there, buy books at thebizarrearchives.com. We ship to the U.S. of A., but if you're not in the U.S. of A. and you are one of our friends on the other side, you can follow the links to your favorite book retailer, such as Amazon or what's the other one? Waterstone, so on and so forth. So we got books for sale all over the place. Very, very cheap, very affordable. So go buy books and help support support folk economy and folk art and literature scenes and publishing, and help us grow and fill the war coffers with coin in our efforts to take back our beloved traditions. So, the bog here today. I got Tristan with me. Unfortunately, Mr. Andre couldn't make it. He's having some technical difficulties. He couldn't hop on with it. So, I got Mr. Tristan with me today. And very, very soon, these shows that we're doing here on YouTube, our live shows, are going to be taken down. So, go back and watch them if you want. And they will be available exclusively on Hearthfire Radio. The bog will be exclusive to Hearthfire Radio subscribers. So you guys are really gonna like it over there. It's gonna be a lot of fun. So without further ado, how we doing, Mr. Tristan? How are you feeling today? How's your holidays coming along?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. I had a great time on my holidays.
Wonderful. It's been crazy for me, man. Crazy. Thanksgiving, I don't even know how we pulled it off. It was a nightmare, but we pulled it off. We got the Yuletide season coming. It's going to be, I think we're going to pull it off. I'll tell you what, I'll be honest with you. It's been a rough year for me this year, especially the last half. Last half of this year has been, I think it's bad for everybody. I've been talking to everybody. Everybody's struggling a little bit with the bad economy and bad luck and freaking this and that. It's been a rough year. So I'm looking forward to putting this one behind us and going into 2024.
Yeah, I think everyone shares that idea at this point.
Yeah. So, let's talk about something good, right? Today we're going to talk about the Æsir and the Vanir, right? We're going to talk about the two tribes of the Holy Golden, of the gods, and who they are. We're going to talk about some ideas about them that may or may not be correct. We are going to talk about who they are, and all this kind of stuff. So, let's get right into it. Tristan, tell us.
Well, I would like to start at the beginning here with a real basic overview of what exactly the Æsir and the Vanir actually are, you know, what they represent. We can divide them fundamentally between two different conflicting patrilineal lines, and one of them is the line of Odin and his brothers and his children. And one of them is the line of Delingurd and his children. Odin is, of course, the Allfather. Everyone knows Odin and all of his children, Thor, Baldur, all of them. But most people probably aren't even aware of who Delingurd is. And that's because he has very limited access in our lore. He's one of those really behind the scenes kind of guys. Delingurd is more or less the father of Njord, who is also the grandfather of Freyr. And he is referred to as the Dayspring. He's like a sun god. And he is married to Nott, Night, then literally the Night. And they have three children. And amongst those were Njord, Jord, and Dagurd, which is the Day. And from that line comes what we generally recognize as the Vanir. All of the Vanir are recognized as being like Delingurd. They're bright and fair and good nature. They're basically sun deities in their appearance. just as we would think of like Freyr and Freya as being like beautiful and bright, like solar deities.
All right. So, there's also this idea that the two tribes of the gods are at odds. Like they had a war, which we know. And because of this, there has risen different kinds of, you know, ideas. Like, for example, Vanatru is something that I see usually on like Facebook. Like among like Facebook McPagans, we'll say that they're Vanatru. They're not heathens, they're Vanatru. What do you think about this?
I can definitely say that Vanatru is an ahistorical idea, that there was never a group of people who only ever worshipped the Vanir. That this is ahistorical. But there is an actually historically accurate idea that went around that there's some sort of tension, and we're not entirely sure how much this actually featured, except that we know that it did. There was some tension between the cult of Odin and the cult of Freyr, in that different areas either probably had one or the other. But these weren't cults differing between the Aesir and the Vanir. Each one of them had generally featured worship of different deities, but they were all heavily intermixed between them. For instance, Baldur was heavily worshipped within the cult of Freyr in his geographical areas, despite actually being the son of Odin. And interestingly enough, Thor was also predominantly worshipped amongst both groups, though he was worshipped very differently. In the Freyr cult, Thor was worshipped more along the lines of probably what many people think of him today as a great warrior, the Thunder Lord, that sort of thing. But in the cult of Odin, he almost assumes some of the place of Freyr, in that he is primarily also worshipped as like an agricultural deity, which is where we get like his sanctity over weddings and crops and fields.
So what is the evidence for this style of worship?
For Vanatru?
For what you're describing.
Oh, for the cultic areas. Well, we can find them it's primarily based on regional identification names, is that any of the areas in which we find large numbers of like fields or temples or hofs or bays or any of that sort that are associated with Freyr, we also find a collection of other deities that are also very common in that geographic area. Like if there's a Freyr's field or temple somewhere, we're also likely to find evidence of the worship of Njord and Freya and Baldur and other similar deities. Ullr is another good one that is commonly worshipped amongst the Freyr cult. Whereas the same is also true of the Odin areas. They're very different geographic areas. You're very unlikely to find a place in which, say, Tyr and Odin and Freyr are all worshipped simultaneously.
So what about, what's it called? Henotheism.
Henotheism is sort of like the idea that all gods are actually real. Like they're not, you know, it's not a rejection of the gods, but only that you believe in one of them as being supreme at the same time, which is not actually part of the cultic practices of our people. There was no idea that Odin, like amongst the Freyr cult, let's say, there was no idea that Odin didn't exist. It was more the sense that they already, for most of the uses that our people had to pray to Odin, was already taken up by their worship of Freyr. So it was more like a preference issue.
So you're saying, so some people will describe like henotheism, like for example, certain Greek city-states will have a patron deity. Right, they'll have a patron deity over the, what is that called, the polis or whatever they called the
city. Polis.
Yeah, and they would have a temple to one deity. This city was considered to belong to that deity, and for the most part, the populace would mostly worship that deity. Is that henotheism, or is that something different?
That would be a little different, but I get what you're going for there. The Greek city-states also didn't believe that their one, like their patron deity was like the only supreme deity. They just believed that they were the protector and patron of their specific city, so they had more practical reason to pray for them for any given thing. Because if you live in Athens, obviously you want to pray to Athena because she really cares about Athens and its citizens.
Mm. And the thing is with like Vana True, and there's some worse ones, right? You have
Rocka True. It's a good one.
Thirsa True. Thirsa, it's like that's not even like if that was a thing back in the day, those people would be like put to death.
I mean, what's really funny is that even though you would think these people would just be put to death, we have no evidence that they ever existed whatsoever.
Yeah. Who would like want to worship like forces of chaos and evil? You know what I mean? Oh yeah, these entities that want to destroy the world and hate humanity and are corrupt and wicked and hideous and monstrous. Let's worship them. Like what kind of silly edgelord dumb shit? And also the Vana True thing. So they say, and their justification for it is that they say what you said, like, oh, there were certain places that held this deity over another. There were certain places that they had, it was complicated. It was a complicated thing back then. But it's, you have people today don't have a lineage to those practices. They just kind of said, okay, well, these people did this like that, so therefore I'm going to adopt this thing that makes me different and special than everybody else, even though there's no tradition or lineage to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the Vana True people are incredibly confused because, as I said, their division wasn't even between the Aesir and the Vanir in particular. It was a much more complex and interwoven like degree of which different deities are worshipped predominantly in each cult. And it wasn't even an exclusive practice. It wasn't like Odin was never worshipped within the areas of the Freyr cult. It's just that he was less worshipped than we would commonly see elsewhere.
So there's also another idea, and I see this get floated by the unis, right? They say some of them make an argument that the Aesir, the cult, or the tribe of Odin, is this, is the patriarchy effectively? They're this like oppressive patriarchy, and the Vanir were this pre-Indo-European, primitive Stone Age, matriarchal like fertility cult, and the cult and the tribe of Odin and his followers like oppress them and wipe them out, and so they have this idea that the Vanir are these like what's that theory, it's a goofy feminist theory about how like the like old world matriarchy or stone right. age matriarchy,
old European matriarchy.
Yeah.
It was very common in proper academic circles up until about the 60s when people started noticing, like, we've been looking into this stuff for a long time now and we still have no evidence for this, and it started dropping off at that point. And it's no longer considered academically valid. Like, the only people who actually believe that are, like, third-wave feminists who just haven't gotten the memo yet. But, in actuality, we've recently discovered that the old Europeans who aren't our ancestors, we're talking about like the old Neolithic Europeans, they actually belong to a patriarchy in and among themselves, and they had like a caste-based hierarchy in which Neolithic farmers were at the bottom, and they were ruled over by European hunter-gatherers, Western hunter-gatherers. And the Western hunter-gatherers themselves had a line of incestuous god kings that spread across Europe. Like, all of the kings in the different areas are part of this giant incestuous bloodline that are so related that we can actually tell them in the fossil record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's really crazy.
That's fascinating. So but what do you think about the idea, because I hear this a lot, that, this also goes into that Tyr was the original Sky Father and Odin overthrew him, which, by the way, that was based on, at least to my knowledge, based on a really, really kind of really flimsy linguistic argument that was put forth by Jacob Grimm, right? Idea that Tyr was Sky Father, which he himself didn't even hang his hat on, and he just kind of threw it out there, just an idea.
I mean, it's true that the word Tyr derives from Dies Pater, like, it's a cognate, right? Except that the word Tyr, to do, is probably just meant God, as it does in the amongst the later, like, Viking Age. It was also the name, proper name of the deity Tyr, but it also meant generically to refer to any sort of god. And it's probably the case that Tyr was not actually Tyr's real name in the same way that Freyr isn't actually a name. It just means Lord.
Yeah. So what's up with this idea? So this gets thrown around a lot. And this is seems kind of strange. It's like, what is the evidence for this? This idea that the Vanir were this Stone Age or pre-Indo-European Neolithic tribe of gods, and they were separate from, like, what is the evidence for that? And is there, like, what, just tell me about that.
Well, I mean, there really is no evidence from that. It has a very flimsy justification based on the idea that the Vanir all seem to kind of be related around processes of nature. Like, they're all kind of like deities of the solar, the wind, night, the day, fertility, that sort of thing. Mm. And that kind of looks like it might fit into the old, you know, 1940s idea of the Neolithic matriarchal cult of peaceful, like, farmers and stuff. But we know that never actually existed, so there couldn't have possibly been a connection there, because it's simply not real. And also, if you look into this with a proper understanding of Indo-European reconstruction, we see that many of the Vanic deities are actually wholly Indo-European constructs, like Njord and Freyr and Freya all have explicit cognates in old European-derived Indo-European cultures.
And I want you to clarify what you mean by constructs there, because some people are going to raise an eyebrow when they hear you say construct.
Oh, yeah. I don't mean constructs in the sense that we devised them. I mean constructs in the sense that, like, we can say that these are things that we recognize as belonging to the category of a cognate.
Yeah. Because there's, especially nowadays, when you say the word construct, people assume that you're talking about something that's man-made and fake.
Right, I realize how you would get that. That's a slip of the tongue on my end. I don't mean to imply that humans have invented the gods, because obviously that would be blasphemous and heretical. I would actually imply quite the opposite here. But yeah, when I use that term, I meant to imply that as we understand it as an idea within, like, anthropology.
Mm. And also, I do want to point out about constructs. There's kind of this idea that... because like, this is a social construct, that's a social construct. Now, this is a completely different topic than what Tristan was talking about. But this idea that construct means fake is, that ain't it. It just ain't it. Constructs are, especially social constructs, are very, very important, and they're good, right? They'll say gender is a social construct, race is a social construct, this is a social construct. Like, all these things are social construct. Constructs are especially social constructs, are an important thing that we use to understand our reality. Right. If we didn't have constructs, if we didn't have socially understood constructs, we would be like walking around naked in a field somewhere, like, just wandering around eating dirt.
I wouldn't even say that constructs are good in that sense. It's just a matter of that they exist. Anything that isn't a tangible physical object is a social construct.
Well, how can I explain this? So, or how can I articulate this? The name that you apply to something that gives it thingness is in of itself a construct.
Right,
categories are constructs.
Like, a soda does not, it's not objectively called soda in, like, the essence of its being, right? That's just the verb and the sounds of the word we make that we all recognize as meaning this thing.
Yeah. And it's important that we have the category of soda. It's important that we have the construct of soda. Say you use something else. Say it's something more important. You, like, Dave is a construct. Dave is a construct. You know, if I'm not Dave, then what am I? You know what I mean? So these are useful things. These are things that have great utility for us in understanding, interacting with our reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's actually a very good interaction here, because most people would assume that you as a singular being is just, like, the default perspective, that, of course, it's objectively true, but it's not actually true. It is, in fact, a kind of social construct that we recognize an individual as being an individual.
Yeah.
And that has knock-on effects that go forward with how we approach with people and their relationship with other people and society.
Yeah. And as time goes on and we begin to... So it is important that you give someone a name that differentiates them from other people. Because if you didn't, you know, how do you talk to people? You know what I mean? I'm Dave, you're Tristan. If I wasn't Dave and you were Tristan, how do we even talk? You know what I mean? It would be really, really confusing. But unfortunately, as time has gone on, especially with the advent of Enlightenment philosophy and so forth, this has become pretty, pretty freaking monstrous, right? It just it reduces to more and more and more isolating and atomizing an individual. And this is a negative construct. This is something that isn't good. Because we are not individuals. There's no such thing as individualism on any level, by any metric. There's no such thing as individualism. You're not even singularly you, right? You are many components going spiritually, physically, mentally, psychologically. All of this stuff, we could talk about this for forever and ever, but all of the various, I don't even know what the various... complexities that go into forming this thing that we identify as you, that we give as you-ness, is not a singular thing. We just do that because if we didn't, it wouldn't make any sense. If you looked in the mirror and saw the umpteen billion freaking complexities that go into building the construct of you, you would go mad, right? You would look at it.
Funnily enough, that would be like cosmic horror, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be some cosmic horror shit. We're talking, that would be some Lovecraft. You'd look in the mirror and see Azathoth, right? But instead, we simplify it and make it easy to understand. And you look in the mirror, I look in the mirror and I see Dave. So it's like, that just makes sense. And it's easy to interact with the reality of Dave instead of the all of the levels of complexities that make up this construct we recognize as Dave.
Yeah, I mean, you're entirely accurate here. I would say that's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of a divergence there, but I think it's important to bring up and talk about because, as you said, we just assume how we, and this instinct is a good thing. The instinct, the function itself, of just like adopting what has been told to you and just like accepting that as your reality and as a default, that instinct is a good thing, unless what you're being told is wrong, which what we have been told is wrong. So it's not so much if we were in a fairer, more just, truer, better world, a more ancestral world, us being told true things and us just accepting it and not going through critical theory and breaking it down and all this kind of stuff, that would be a good thing, right? That function is a good thing. The problem with it is that when we get to now, when people get, they inherit all of these really problematic priors, it becomes a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. And we could go on a tangent about that for much, much more. We could probably have an entirely other episode on it.
Yeah. So, yeah, guys, social constructs are a good thing. They can be. They are mostly a good thing. Somebody in the short stocking says neighborhoods are a social construct. That's correct. Who doesn't want to live in a neighborhood? Who doesn't want to have neighbors? Who doesn't want to have a family? Who doesn't want to be you? You know what I mean? Like, who doesn't want that? Who don't want that? Who doesn't want things like justice, right? Justice and truth. These things are social constructs, and they're good things. So,
Well, I think if we return to the idea you had here about how do we know that the Vanir are not a Neolithic European kind of construction, I think we can actually... say that explicitly this is refuted by the edit itself. In fact, everyone pretty much knows that there was once a war between Nazir and the Vanir, but most people don't realize that the Vanir actually won that war. It says here in the edit, in Veluspa, on the host his spear did Othin hurl, then in the world did war first come. The wall that girdled the gods was broken, and the field by the warlike queens was trodden. Then sought the gods their assembly seats, the holy ones in council held, whether the gods should tribute give or to all alike should worship belong.
Yeah.
And this was back when the Vanir and the Aesir had a war over who should be directed the tribute of worship. And the Vanir won and broke the walls of Asgard, and that's why they now live together in peace and harmony with each other.
And they effectively have become one tribe.
Right, more or less. They have intermarried amongst each other so heavily that they are effectively inseparable. Mm-hmm. But we can tell from this that there was no possible way for the Vanir to be a group of Neolithic pantheon deities, because the Indo-Europeans exterminated these people, and obviously their gods didn't win.
Yeah. And who's we don't even really know who their gods were. They could have had the same gods or similar gods or something of that nature. We have no idea.
Well, I would say it's very unlikely they would have had similar or the same gods, because only Indo-Europeans have Indo-European gods, generally speaking. But it's true that we have no idea what these people's culture or religion was actually based around.
But we do have admixture of these peoples. We do.
Yes, our ancestors killed all of the men, but not the women.
So, but what I would say is, you know, I just don't want to. So, what makes us who we are is that the Indo-Europeans came and did their thing, and then intermarried with the women of the Neolithic farmers. And then the blend of those two peoples became us and made us unique.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So without those peoples, we wouldn't have our uniqueness today. We would be the same as, you know, the Indo-Europeans that went all over the world. And that was an important genetic evolution, because that was an ethnogenesis that created Europeans. Right.
I would even say that the idea of Europeans isn't quite accurate, because the different genetic mixes are very different. People in Southern Europe or Western Europe, like there's a delineation line, the further west you go and the further south you go, you're more likely to have significantly more Neolithic European ancestry, and then hunter-gatherer ancestry, and then a smaller amount of steppe-based ancestry, whereas the northern and eastern areas, like Scandinavians or like Baltic Slavs, are much more likely to have large amounts of steppe ancestry, a large amount of hunter-gatherer ancestry, and a small amount of Neolithic European.
Yeah, and then also there are pockets in different areas that completely flip that upside down.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty unique. So, but this is a good thing. This is a beautiful thing. That the different regions of Europe under the umbrella of Europeans have uniqueness of themselves. That's a beautiful thing. You know what I mean? Even in a place, for example, the Mediterranean, we kind of view like Mediterraneans as one type of guy, right? We think of, you know, when an American specifically thinks of a Mediterranean, we think of, I don't know, freaking, you know, Joe Pesci, or the guy at the pizza place.
Right. I would imagine like someone who's like Greek or Italian.
Yeah.
Maybe Spanish.
But the truth of the matter is, even in Greece, Greece is a little bit of a different story, but let's say Italy, Portugal, Spain, these places, there's like genetic uniqueness in these places as well, right? There are pockets in Italy. Let's talk about Italy. So in Italy, so especially us as Americans, we have this idea in our head of what Italian looks like. We have an idea in our head what Spanish looks like. And, you know, for the most part, the majority of people that came from those countries that came to the New World came from the similar areas. Italy, most people came from Southern Italy, Sicily, and places like that. Not a whole lot of Northern Italians came to America. So we have this idea in our head, even among Italian Americans, they look at each other as they have a very specific idea of what Italian looks like. You go to Italy, it's very, very different. There are people, you go to Northern Italy, they look completely different than the people in Southern. People in Northern Italy have more genetically in common with the Swiss than they do with, you know, Sicilians or Sardinians or something like that, right? So there's even pockets in these little areas that have genetic uniqueness because they are different composites of different pre-European stocks, right? And the same thing goes for Northwestern Europe too. Old Celts are genetically more related to Romans than they are to Saxons, right? And you go to Ireland, you see all these different people. There's like here in America, we have a term Black Irish. If you're Black Irish, that means you're a swarthy Irishman. Swarthy Irishmen are people that have high amounts of Neolithic farmer. And then the stereotypical red hair and freckles Irishmen that we see in our heads, they got that from the Norse. The Norse brought that DNA, right? And so it's really interesting. It's fascinating. And this isn't the idea that we have all of this uniqueness among each other and different genetic differentiation is a good thing, and it's a beautiful thing, right? I don't know. So I agree with you, Tristan, that even the idea of a singular Europeanness is not accurate. I don't know. We all come from the similar root, but because as time went on and different composites of peoples evolved, we evolved to have uniqueness. And I think uniqueness is a beautiful thing. Because I oppose this modern idea that everybody is the same, everybody, you know, one race, the human race, and freaking, you know, we are the world, we are the children, like all this, it's dumb, it sucks. Uniqueness is beautiful because even on a fundamental ontological level, that which gives something thingness are the attributes that differentiate it from other things. And that gives them value and function and makes them, you know, gives it that which is different has more value, right? Ideas like, for example, when we look at what makes gold valuable or what, let's talk about diamonds. You know, what makes diamonds valuable? This is completely astroturf. Diamonds are not actually valuable. It's completely fabricated because they're given rareness. Artificially given rareness, and in rareness just means like extreme levels of difference, extreme levels of distinction from other things. You can't, like with diamonds, you can't get diamonds or not like nothing else, right? So they give them false rareness to make them more valuable. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do have to say we have a couple comments here I would like to address. Kitty Shortstockings asks, is Frigg a Vanir that Odin married for peace? This long and short answer to that is, the short answer would be yes. The long answer is a lot more complicated, and it depends on whether you subscribe to the idea, as I do, that Freya and Frigg are actually the same deity, or there is the opposing view that Frigg is actually Freya's mother, Yord. But in either way, whichever way you fall down on that, obviously, yes, she's one of the Vanir that Odin married for peace.
Yeah.
Abinai says, it's all the same people, just difference due to the diversity of the Caucasoids. This is kind of correct. The idea of the Caucasoid people is something that's primarily based around like I can't even figure out the word now. I'm sorry. An idea based on the conception of skull shape primarily, and it's not actually due to actual hereditary descent. Like it mixes up North Africans and Semites and Indo-Europeans and all these other people that are vaguely around the Mediterranean that have like some shared amount of genetic background, but who don't all necessarily derive from the same kind of source. So I would say that the use of the term Caucasoids is probably not exactly relevant here when for most people, like for instance, if we're talking about the similarities between a European man and a Indian man, the similarity isn't that they're Caucasoids in an aesthetic sense. It's that they're all fundamentally Indo-Europeans, which for instance, a North African man, like let's say an Ethiopian, might have a Caucasoid skull shape, but as opposed to the European and the Indian man, he is not a European, or an Indo-European, I mean.
Yeah. And also modern Indians are pretty far removed from being Indo-European as well. Well, not all, but even in India, there's some really different ethnic groups in India.
I mean, to say all of India is sort of like a misapprehension, because there are definitely different areas and subgroups within India. Some Indians probably aren't actually Indo-Europeans, like the tribal groups, but for most of like the common Orthodox Indian society, any of the twice-born people that are like the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, and the Vaishya, they are very much descended from Indo-Europeans in a patrilineal sense.
So, Bog Hag, yeah, that's correct. De Beers Company made diamonds valuable. That's correct. It's completely fabricated, as I said. So,
Bog says a lot of blonde Viking-looking North Italians. That's actually really interesting because during the Middle Ages, most people don't realize the Normans from France, the same guys who conquered England and became the aristocracy there, right? They actually also conquered Northern Italy and set up a kingdom there. And that's why Northern Italians are actually much more likely to have fair skin and blonde hair. And it's because they are literally just Germanic people.
Yeah. Same. Well, there's, so here's the deal is that, Italy has been, was conquered several times by Germanic peoples. It was conquered by the Goths. It was conquered by the Lombards, and it was conquered then by the Normans. So, there's a lot of Germanic ancestry. You can walk around, you go to Italy in certain pockets, and you'll be like, am I in freaking, is this Holland? You know what I mean? Like, you, there are people, not all Italians are, you know, olive complexion, you know, Greek looking.
A surprising number of Italians look like me, and I'm a Scandinavian.
Yeah, exactly. So, my mother is Southern Italian, right? They're from Calabria on my mom's side. A lot of my family are gingers, right? On their genetic tests, it says that they have Germanic DNA. It's like, where'd that come from? They're from Calabria. You know what I mean? So when I hang out, when I talk to like Italian Americans, they look at me and they're like, you're not. But if I go talk to people from Italy, they can mistake me for being Italian because there are Italians that look like me. You know what I mean? And then there are Swiss, you know what I mean? My father's family comes from the Alpine regions. So there are Swiss people that speak Italian, that have large traces of Italian admixture. And then there are German speakers that have, you know, Roman noses and stuff like that. It's really unique. It's not as clear cut as sometimes people try to make it out to be, right? Not only did we have all of these different admixtures after the we're talking, when did the Indo-European invasion happen?
Around 25 to 3,500 years.
Yeah. So between those thousands of years, there were tons of wars and invasions with in the Middle Ages and before, in the Bronze Age, and you had the Roman era, and, you know, there's lots of migrations in all throughout Europe. So it's not cut and dry. It's not as easy as saying these people are this, these people are that, these people are this. Over time, we've evolved to have all kinds of different uniqueness and different ethnogenesises. What's plural of genesis? Genocide? Or is it genesises?
Yeah, ethnogenesis.
Ethnogenesis.
Or ethnogenesis is actually the plural, I think. Ethnogenesis would be the singular.
Oh. Hmm. You guys know what I'm talking about. But it's cool. It's fascinating. It's a beautiful thing. It's not a bad thing. And to try to put everybody through the modern global meat grinder of, you know, turning everybody into a singular gray lump is wrong. Is wrong. It rapes people of their folkishness, of their uniqueness, and robs them of their identities and turns them into, you know, little consumer bug men that fall into one category for the sake of efficiency, right? It's pretty wrong. It's probably the most monstrous thing of this age.
To discuss the meaning of social constructs here, I would say that what should really matter is that we are patrilineally Indo-Europeans, because that's what our own forefathers believed mattered. they lived in patriarchal, patrilineal cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
They might not have been aware that distant people had the exact same paternal line as them, but if they did, that probably would have changed how they viewed them.
Yeah. I just brought that up because I think it's important to, acknowledge the peoples that went into giving us uniqueness. You know what I mean? I am me and you are you, and we look the way that we look today and think the way we think today because we are a blend of all of those people, you know, of the Indo-Europeans and the Neolithic farmers and the Western hunter-gatherers and all this kind of stuff. So I just don't, you know, plus they built Stonehenge, and Stonehenge is pretty cool. So, okay, where are we at here? Let's talk about, let's go back to the topic for the show here. Let's talk about the deities themselves. Let's talk about the deities themselves. And before we get into this, I want to clarify the idea of deities having functions, because a lot of people purport the nature heresy, that the deities are just, you know, aspects or representations of nature, which is ridiculous. Why would you sacrifice animals and plead and beg and pray and love and celebrate and build rituals? Why would you worship like the wind or trees or, you know, a thunderstorm? That can't interact with you.
It sort of implies that our ancestors didn't know what the wind or fire was, and that it obviously couldn't help them if they plead to it.
Yeah, this is what's really monstrous about modern ideology, is that it progressivism is this idea, and I'm not talking about progressivism in terms of modern politics or what you see on TV. I'm talking about the mentality of progressivism, that everything going forward is good and smart, and everything going backwards is backwards and dumb and stupid.
Oh, and you mean Wiggian historiography?
What's that mean?
It's what you're discussing right now, actually. The singular line of human society in which we're just progressing steadily upwards. It's an idea of history that was established by the Whigs and popularized by them. So it's called Whiggian historiography.
Yeah, it's this idea that, and it's the same reason that when you watch a Hollywood movie about the ancient past, look at it, even just like medieval Europe is always filthy and dirty and gray and brown, and the people are missing teeth and they're all despondent. You know, that's not how it was. You know what I mean? It's not how it was. When you watch a show about like that hideous history channel show, Vikings, like those people are all filthy. They look like primitives. Their houses are all dirty. They're dumb. So there's this presupposition among these people that things going backwards and into the past are dumb and inferior, and then everybody now is smart. So just this idea of our ancestors just worshipped nature, like physical nature, just presupposes that they were retarded. And that's so wrong and incorrect. The truth of the matter is that it's very possible that they were smarter than we are today. Yeah, we could definitely see that even in the span since we've invented psychometrics, since we've invented IQs or how to measure IQ points. You know, the people of the past were on average smarter than us. We're not very smart on average. We're also not very healthy on average. The truth of the matter, your average European medieval peasant probably had a better life than most middle class people do today. They had more nutritious food. They had stronger spines. They had wider jaws, which means that they had higher testosterone. We could dig these people up from the past. They had better teeth. Their teeth didn't rot out because they didn't eat sugar, and they just had better teeth genes, which teeth actually show a lot about people's genetics. So this idea that the people of the past were these like weak, dumb, you know, backwards people, it's just not the case. These people were very, very smart. They had a sophisticated world for their time and their level of technology. They were very strong. These are the kind of, here's the deal. You could just go back you know, a couple hundred years. And this is one thing I actually like about what Joe Rogan, with Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan is fascinated by this. He brings up pictures of people from like the 1800s. And he's like, look at that fucking guy. You know, he's made of steel. This guy is so grim and strong and blah. And he's like, nobody could even beat this. And he's right. Dude, your average, like, you know, fist fighter from the 1800s that was doing those fisticuffs, like, underground, he would, like, beat the dog shit out of most MMA fighters today. He was just made of better stuff. He was just tougher. He was more lank. He was just stronger. They were just stronger, superior men. He was probably, he also had, on average, a higher IQ than people do today. So this idea that people in the past were dumb and dirty and backwards and that we're so smart and better today is just, I hate to say this because science sucks, but is a denial of science, of all empirical evidence.
Yeah, I would say to bring it back to hear what you were getting at about the functions of the deities.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though we're going to speak about the functions, I don't want people to get the misunderstanding here that we're talking about deities in some sort of like constructed archetypal sense. Like, even though Thor is, we could say, is the god of thunder and his function is over that idea, right? It's not that Thor is literally thunder and lightning and that he's just a representation of this. It's more accurate to say that Thor does many things that are just Thor, and amongst them is stuff like lightning and thunder. But that's kind of a mouthful to say, so in order to actually talk about it, we do have to say it in a reasonable social manner, so we're just going to call it a function.
Okay, so let's talk about the deities themselves and how we can understand them.
Right, so the first deity we're going to talk about briefly is Odin, the Allfather. So most everyone here probably understands who Odin is. He's the god of wisdom and war. Odin is the father of victory. He is a god of magic and cunning, especially a god of kings and governance, poetry and wisdom. And he is also Bord's son. He is of the patrilineal line of the Aesir, and almost everyone involved in that takes their belongingness in the tribe of the Aesir from their descent from Odin or one of his brothers. So the next one we could go over is Freyr, who is pretty much the exact polar opposite in this, in that Freyr is the god of the sun, he is the god of light, he is the god of kingship, he is the prince. He is referred to as the most renowned of the gods. He is also the traditionally the head, the patriarch of the Swedish royal house. So the people in the Inglings believe that they descended from Freyr himself, which is probably why we get the cult of Freyr in those areas. And that's why, especially he contrasts to Odin here, is that a lot of people worshipped Odin as a sort of aristocratic god of jarls and other lords and kings. And in some areas, probably because they had the Inglings, is that they preferred to worship Freyr as the prince and the king and the god of aristocracy and sovereignty. But Freyr is also a god of he's a god of oaths and peace and the relationships between other people. He's also a god of fertility and the fields in a sort of a Fisher King setup. Like, you know, like when you watch like a Disney movie and you see like the rightful king has returned and now the land is prosperous and everyone is having a great time. That's sort of a very Germanic idea that because the king is actually the king, his luck is the one that gives everyone prosperity. Freyr is the ultimate king in that sense because he rules everyone is prosperous in an agricultural and fertile sense. He also controls money, prosperous in not only like wheat and grain, but also in mercantile endeavors.
Mm.
The third one here is Thor. Everyone knows Thor. He's the great thunderer, the defender of Asgard and of man. And Thor also has connections to him based around fertility. And this is because most people don't realize that Freyr and Thor are actually half-brothers. Freyr's mother is Yord, and Thor's mother is Yord. They have the same mother. That's probably why they share this overlap within agricultural and prosperity.
Hmm.
Thor has two children, Magni and Mothi. They don't really have a lot of function, or they weren't widely worshipped amongst themselves, but they are there amongst the Aesir, so I wanted to discuss them in that. They will eventually, their fate is that after Ragnarok, they will take up Thor's hammer and become like the new Thor. The fourth deity we can talk about is Njord. Njord is the father of Freyr and Freya, and he is a god of the sea, the wind, and fire. And he is probably also recognizable as the patriarch of the Dvanic line. Everyone who is Vanir is in some sense related to Njord. And he was also widely worshipped as a god of temples. So he was believed to own many temples, which we haven't actually found a whole lot of evidence for in the archaeological record, except that we know some very large areas were dedicated to Njord, like modern-day Trondheim was one of the main cultic luminary associations with Njord, so that you had like a large regional temple there. The fifth one would be Freya. Freya is the twin sister of Freyr and the daughter of Njord. She is a goddess who is associated with war and magic primarily, and also beauty and light. Freya is a deity that is considered probably the most easy for people to pray to, because she is the most willing of deities in order to help other men. Dave, would you like to take over the list and start at Frigg?
So yeah, Frigg is the wife of Odin. She is the Earth Mother. A lot of people will equate her to other Germanic cognates, such as some people will say that she is also Nerthus. Some people will say that she is, what's the Alpine name for her? Lady Perta or Berta, she gets called sometimes. This is, you know, she oversees things like wives. She oversees marriages. She oversees children and childcare. She's like this, she's a very loving, maternal woman, right? Some people will make the argument that she is the same as Yord, right? I don't know how you feel about that cognate, Tristan, but, you know, I think, you know, who knows?
Well, as we discussed earlier, I am a proponent of the idea that Frigga and Freya are actually the same being. But I do think that Freya's mother, Yord, and Nerthus and Earth are all the same being.
Hmm. You want to do... that's Frigg. You pray to her during times of when you have a wedding, when you birth a child, when... you know, she's also a pretty important figure, a very important deity, like I mentioned, among Alpine peoples. And there's actually quite a few practices that exist today that have been Christianized that people believe are very ancient, right? Frigg was kind of the matron of the Lombards. And in places in Italy where the Lombards conquered, in other Mediterranean areas, they do like a festival of the mother. I can't remember exactly what it's called. They call it the Blessed Mother now, but they get like goats or donkeys or horses, and they put the Blessed Mother on a cart and wheel it in and make offerings to her throughout all of town, and they have a big parade. Well, this is very, very similar to the ancient practice of what they would do with their Earth Mother deity, and some people believe this to be Frigg, they would put the mother deity on a cart, her effigy, and they would wheel her through towns and make offerings to her, and at the end have a big bloat and sacrifice all of it into a lake. So there's also a name for her in certain Alpine regions. They call her Frau Hola, and Hola literally means Frau, like mother of the whole. And what this means is they believe that she was also somewhat of a psychopomp. So when you would die, your grave would be a hole that goes to the underworld, and she would guide you to the underworld so that you may start your journey into the afterlife. So she's a very important deity among many peoples.
Right, that's true. So now let's go on to Sif. Sif is the wife of Thor, and she also has associations with Golden Fields fertility. She's sort of like another Earth Mother kind of deity. I actually make an interesting argument in my newest book that I'm currently writing, that there is an actual Indo-European root between her, that there are kind of two different Earth Mother deities. There's the Earth Mother proper and also the Earth Mother's daughter, which is sort of like Demeter and Persephone. So I would say that Sif is cognate to that function, and that she fulfills that role as the lesser Earth Mother. But in Norse myth, she is also married to Thor, and that's primarily where she goes. She has the myth in which Loki cuts all of her hair off, and Loki is forced to have the dwarves construct trellises of gold for her.
Yeah. So. And then the next one is Idun, and Idun is the goddess that gives the apples of immortality, right? She is a deity that's very much associated with youth and health and beauty and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would also say that Idun is a very interesting deity, in that we know she explicitly is one of the Alfar. Her father is Ivaldi, who is one of the Alfar. And for those who don't know, an Alfar is an elf in English. They come from Alfheim, which Freyr rules Alfheim as their prince, and are heavily associated with the Vanic deities. So it's probably the case that even though we don't have any definitive genealogical records for Sif or Ithun, that they are probably in some sense connected to the Vanir.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Skadi, right? Skadi, who was a Jotun until she got married to Njord. Her father was, what was her father's name? Thjazi. Yeah. So she is very much associated with mountains and hunting and winter and things like this, right? She's also somewhat, like I mentioned about Frau Hola and Frau Perchta and Berta, like the other names of who are believed to be Frigg. It's also somewhat believed to be somewhat cognate to Skadi, because in certain Alpine religions, we know that their understanding of Frau Hola, of Frigg, was that she was the mother of the mountain. And it's very possible that these two goddesses were sort of blended together in some ways. And, you know, it's just interesting.
Yeah. Next we have Vithar. Vithar is the son of Odin by the Jotun Glithr. And he is famous for, it is his fate to avenge his father's death at the hands of the Fenris wolf at Ragnarok. Vithar will take up a great shoe, which he has, and put it on the mouth of the Fenris wolf, and then extend his jaws up into the heavens and break them apart and thereby kill him. And because of that, he's associated with vengeance. He is also referred to as the Wide Ruler, primarily because he makes this great step. Dumuzil has some very interesting information about that. He ties with Vishnu in Hinduism. But also he's referred to as the silent god, because he's a very introverted and taciturn figure who doesn't speak much.
Yeah. So the next one we could talk about is Vali, right? Vali was born out of the relationship between Odin and the giantess Rind, right? And that's a whole big story. It's a very complex story. But he is born, Vali is one of the sons of Odin, and he is born to get revenge for the killing of Baldur, right? He goes and he kills Hod, right? And he's the one that damns Loki, right?
Yeah, pretty much. After Lokasenna, Vali grabs Loki and kills one of his sons, and then rips out his entrails and binds him to a rock with it.
Yeah, he's the guy that finally gives Loki his due, Right. And he's also said to survive Ragnarok. And who knows where that you go with that. Go ahead.
Actually, it's interesting because the Voluspa says that Beefar will take up a Hautain. It's called a Hautain, which is literally speaking, it's sort of like a blood stick, which is used in to give bloat. So it's sort of implied that Beefar will take up the function of a priest.
Well, so in Voluspo, it says, it talks about, what does it say? It says, I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but it pretty much says that he's going to survive. It says, what is it? I should have freaking wrote it down. I can't remember. You guys could go open your Eddas. I'm terrible
So it's hard to just pull these things up from the bottom of your head in the moment, of course. Even though you know what you're talking about, it's very difficult to just say it.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's go on. We're going to talk about Baldur. Dave, would you like to handle Baldur?
So Baldur is another son of Odin. He's the most beautiful god, right? He is the representation of masculine beauty in its purest, highest form. So much so, and he's actually the catalyst that brings on all of the troubles later on, because when he is killed, all the world weeps. He was so beautiful and so great that all of the world weeps, and Odin goes and does this thing with Rind in order to get revenge, right? His father Odin was so distraught that he went and did all of these things to get revenge for his son slaying the most beautiful of the gods.
Yeah, and to continue it onwards, Baldur actually has a son named Forseti. Forseti is a god of the ting and law. He's the greatest lawman, and as most people recognize Tyr as being a god of the ting, as a ting tier. But Forseti is almost the opposite, in the sense that Tyr gives very harsh and traditional judgments that often involve violence, whereas Forseti is known for bringing everyone together in peaceful accord. He gives out like payment for things and stuff like that, so he settles everything peacefully. And he is the son of Baldur.
Mm-hmm.
So let's now go with Bragi.
Here, you can take that one. I'm looking up some notes here.
All right. Bragi is a god primarily associated with poetry and song. He is the main poet of the gods, and when he lives in Asgard, he is also recognized as the son of Odin. Even though Odin is known as the song father and probably invented poetry, Bragi is the one who really mastered the art amongst the gods, and he's known for this. He's very prominent in the Lokasenna, in which he has a long argument with Loki over the matter of his own courage and station within society.
And then we have Heimdall. This is a big one. Heimdall is a big one. So Heimdall is another one, son of Odin, right? He is considered the whitest of the gods. He is the priest of the gods. He is who brings the teachings of religion to man. You know, the sons of Heimdall, all of this kind of stuff. It's believed that he is also cognate to Rig and maybe even King Skef. That's up for debate. Who really knows what it is? But he is a very important deity because he is, represents this stuff. He's kind of like the god of ritual and practice.
I mean, I should take a note here that this would be a very Rydbergian sectarian belief here. I would not endorse the idea that Heimdall is a god of the priests, is a priest of the gods or associated with ritual or practice.
Really? Fact, why?
Because I would say that Freyr is actually the god of the priests and should be associated in this sense. Rydberg makes the argument that Heimdall should have this role because he is cognate to Agni, but I believe Rydberg is actually incorrect and that Agni should be cognate to Freyr. Though I do agree that it is probably the case, or at least there's a very good argument to be made that Heimdall is cognate to Rig, so he might actually be the father of mankind in that sense. But I don't believe there's any association with Heimdall and ritual or priestly practice within the poetic texts. Though what it is said is that Heimdall is still a very important god. He's still the whitest of the gods. He's very beautiful. And interestingly enough, like the Vanir, he is said to have a type of forethought where the Vanir are very famous for being able to like prophesy and have like spontaneous glimpses of the future. Heimdall is also known to have this trait as well. He can see the future. He is also the guardian of the Bifrost, which is very important.
Yeah. So you also have Tyr, right? Tyr is, everybody knows who Tyr is. It's actually, there's not a lot said about him, right?
Surprisingly little for what is effectively a very major god.
Yeah. We all know about the story of him and the great wolf, the devourer wolf, and him tricking the wolf by sacrificing his hand to put him in chains. He's obviously, for this reason, associated with sacrifice. He's also associated with law, but as Tristan said before, more about justice on the battlefield through violence, maybe executions and things like that, as opposed to, you know, having to sit down at the thing.
Well, it mostly goes into how our ancestors conceptualized law. And today we think of law as being like something that's wholly against violence, right? Like you go to the court and then you get like an outcome and then you just have to do it. Whereas our ancestors believed that the court, the law king, was more like a justification that could sanction like your vengeance. So that, say, there was really only two options. Either you come to the law king and you make an accord and there's a payment in gold for whatever crime has been committed, which would fall under Forseti. Forseti is very good at that sort of thing. And if you can't come to a resolution, then it comes to vengeance. It has to be settled amongst people, as in violence. So there has to be like a slaying up to even out the sides. And that would be more like more for Tyr's function in the courts. He is someone who, when something wrong has been gone down, he sanctions the vengeance and the warfare that comes after.
Yeah. So
the final one is the god Ullr, which I noticed the comments were also asking about, which is very reasonable because most people don't really know much about Ullr. He's a very mysterious god in that respect. Ullr is a god of skiing and winter and archery and also duels. He was prayed to before people did Holmgang, especially because he was the patron of single combat.
Yeah, he's also associated with, you know, hunting and frost. You already said winter, I believe, but you know, he's very associated with the bow, and you know, the bow. There's a lot of symbolism with the bow. We said earlier about Skadi is also associated with the bow. I'm not going to get into it because it's a little bit esoteric and some speculation. Doesn't really. We could get into that at another time. But Ullr is very much associated, not just with the hunt, but also I've read that he's associated with things like victory, because his name literally, if you trace it back, the etymology literally means glory. So Ullr is a guy that you know, of the victorious hunt, someone that a deity you pray to when you want to win, right?
Yeah, it's very much the case. Yeah. It should also be mentioned that Ullr is actually the stepson of Thor. He's not actually Thor's son, but Sif had a previous child from a previous marriage. And we don't know who Ullr's actual father is. It's just not recorded anymore. But we know that his mother was Sif, and he is Thor's stepson.
Yeah.
Also, we know that Ullr was associated with oaths and authority. He's probably the Great Ass mentioned in our ancestral oath, which is given to Freyr, Njord, and the Great Ass, which is probably Ullr.
Why do you think that?
It makes a similar... There's a similar argument to be made in Grimnismal, in which when Odin comes before the king there, he mentions Ullr in the context of oath and authority, that he looks upon him and... can sanctify his oath in a similar way that makes it the argument that he's probably also talking about the same deity in the Great Oz. Though the second argument there is also that the Great Oz is probably Odin. So it's either one of the two.
There's also some associations with Uller and the yew tree. And there's some, you know, symbolism and stuff with that, but you know, we're starting to run out of time. Yew, a lot of times associated with bows, and like I said before, bows have some symbolism across all Indo-European corpuses. For example, you know, freaking, I don't know, my brain's going on to like the next thing and next thing. But for example, like if you look at the horoscope, Sagittarius has a bow, and what this symbolizes is to look forward, which is also interesting because if you go back further, the etymology of Uller's name, it goes to the Proto-Indo-European word Wultaz, which means to see. Or not just like to like see, but to have like superior sight, right? So this idea to look forward with the bow, to have sight, or these things are all kind of connected to one another.
Yeah, it also might mean glory or wealth.
Yeah. Very interesting. All right. If anybody has any, we are over an hour. We're going to start wrapping it up here. Mr. Tristan, is there anything else you would like to speak on?
No, I believe we finished up all my stuff.
So if anybody has any questions or anything they'd like to bring up, please ask in the chat now. We could always take a super chat if you would like to make a donation to the BOG. But we're going to start wrapping it up here, guys. You know, thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate all you guys. Hails and blessings to everybody. Like I said before at the beginning, very soon, the BOG will be going over to Hearthfire Radio, and these shows will no longer be on YouTube. I think I'm going to switch up my YouTube channel a little bit, start doing some different kind of stuff on my YouTube channel, so it's a little bit more built for YouTube, right? So
I have to say I've always liked your driving and ranting videos, but I suppose the comment section can attest to that.
Yeah, maybe I'll bring those back. The driving around, hooting and hollering. Problem is, I don't have a good phone anymore. I've been having bad luck with phones over the last few years. I get a phone, I drop it, it like starts dying, whatever. I can't find a good phone.
Everyone send in super chats and get Dave a new rant phone.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys send in the super chats and buy me a new phone. I'll start doing the car rants again. Because I have a lot of, dude, there's a lot of stuff that goes through my mind. Like during the day that I would love to talk about, do a video about, but because I'm so goofy and ADD and, you know, it just like falls out of my head and I lose it forever if I don't write it down, which I almost never do. So, yeah, I guess we could get back to doing that. And, you know, I got a lot of stuff lined up, guys. I got a lot of stuff I'm working on. I got a card game I'm working on. I got a tabletop game I'm working on. We have a video game project, which you guys could go check out over at thebizarrearchives.com and scroll down and click on Grim Earth, the video game project. We got a film project. We got books coming out. We got all kinds of stuff. We're working very, very hard for you guys to give you guys, you know, what you need. So you don't need to go to, you know, the bad guys with all of their crap. We can build our own. We can build our own everything. Tristan has a book coming out very soon. There's lots of great stuff coming. So everybody, stay tuned. Keep your eyes peeled, and you know, keep an eye out for other stuff coming. I do not think that we are going to do live streams of the BOG going forward. I think we are going to start building up the catalog for when Hearthfire launches. So this might be the last time that the BOG is on YouTube. So just putting that out there. But guys, I got a sale going on. The Bizarrearchives. Go buy Bizarrearchives books. TheBizarrearchives.com. Follow us on Twitter and Telegram at The Bizarrearchives. And lots of cool stuff. I got shirts over there. I got art prints. I got all kind of stuff. So I'll check you guys next time. Hails and blessings to everybody. Next time we talk here on The Bog. Hail.